Thank you. I'm Patty. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be sober. I'm grateful to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank my friend Bob for inviting me and giving me an opportunity to participate in my recovery. And boy, this room is full of people who I know and who I love. George, who I'm aiming to be my next ex-husband, sitting up in the front. He told me every time I mentioned his name, he'd pay me $5. So if somebody would keep track of how much he owes me, last time he didn't pay up. Chuck and Joanne, who were in the first meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that I attended, and there's just so many people here that I couldn't name you all, but I'm grateful. I'm grateful to be standing here tonight sober. I want to thank the two 10-minute speakers. I identified with Michelle. I also grew up in an alcoholic house. The occupants were a little dysfunctional, but the house was really normal. I did not aim for Alcoholics Anonymous. That wasn't what I was going for at birth, but I'm grateful to have arrived here. I was driving up from Southern California and, with cruise control on because I have a formerly speeding problem. I was going to a work-related meeting one morning, and I was driving along the Southern California freeways at a pretty good clip. If you can get a speeding ticket on a Southern California freeway, you're doing good. And I was on my way to this meeting, the red light came on behind me, and I know what that means. It means pull over. And I pulled over, and the officer came up and told me I'd been speeding. And I said, well, I wasn't the fastest car on the road. And he gave me the ticket anyway. And I went to, I decided to go to court because I was indignant. I wasn't the fastest car on the road. And I went to night court. I didn't want to miss work by going to court. So I went to night court in Pomona. And if you're ever in Southern California, I want to tell you, Pomona is not the place you want to shoot for. And you don't want to go there at night. But I went to night court in Pomona, and all the criminals and I were in there. And the judge said, the people that were going to plead guilty, they were going to go first. So everybody who pleaded guilty went first, and then he dealt with some other people, and then he called my name, and he asked me if I was innocent or guilty, and I said, well, I wasn't the fastest car on the road. Apparently, that wasn't one of my choices. He asked me again, and I once again answered I wasn't the fastest car on the road, and so he suggested I go sit down, and he worked on everybody else, and it was just me and this other guy over there, and got to be my turn again, and he asked me again, guilty or innocent, and I had what I know tonight is the moment of clarity, because I was standing there and I thought, not one of the fastest cars on the road is not one of the answers. And I share that with you because what I suffer from is alcoholism. I don't suffer from alcoholism. I suffer from alcoholism. And my ism tells me that I'm bigger than the rules. My ism tells me that, you know, the speed limit says 55, but that doesn't mean me. No parking at the curb, you know, the white curb is for arriving and departing passengers only. No parking, it doesn't mean me. You know, the handicap part, well, it doesn't mean me. I'm only running in for a minute. And my disease tells me I'm bigger than the rules. I wasn't the fastest car on the road, but the truth was that I was exceeding the speed limit. And I had that moment of clarity standing. Well, I figured the judge didn't want to hear it. He was already just a little bit annoyed with me, and so I pled guilty, and I had to go to traffic school. I haven't had a traffic ticket in over 24 years at that time, and I didn't know what traffic school was, and now that I know, I never want to go back. So I drive on, I put it on cruise, and I'm going the speed. And you know how many people flip you off when you're doing the speed limit. It's a lot. I don't know how many miles it was from home to here, but I counted 13 people flipping me off as I was. And because of my recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't have to flip them off. I didn't have to speed up, get in front of them, and slam on my brakes. So if you're new, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous works, and it works good. I, unlike Frank or Roger, I can't remember because I thought you were Dick Martin. Unlike our second 10-minute speaker, I do remember my first drink. I had my first drink of alcohol when I was 13 years old. I'm sorry I waited that long, but I didn't know what alcohol would do to me or for me. As far as I can recall, I never thought about drinking one way or another. I never thought I wouldn't drink. I didn't think I can't wait until I drink. I just never really thought much about alcohol one way or another. And yet when I was 13 years old, I was on a camping trip with a group of girls. We were camping on the beach just south of Oceanside in Southern California. And when we got into the tent that night, I had a bottle of vodka in my pillowcase. And to this day, I don't know where that bottle came from. I often have said it was the grace of God, but I can never be sure. But I remember pulling the bottle out, and I remember being excited about having it. And I don't know about anybody else in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I never had resentments until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I never had resentments out there. How about you? I mean, I dealt with them right now. One of my early resentments in Alcoholics Anonymous was I heard folks talk about their first drink. And they talked about taking the drink, and they felt the warmth in their mouth. And they, I don't know, somehow they felt it as it went down their throat. They could track it as it went down, and it hit their stomach. And it hit their stomach, exploded, went to their fingernails, their toenails, their pimples fell off, they grew a few inches, they dropped about 20 pounds, they became Prince Charles, Lady Di. I mean, wonderful things happened to them. And that wasn't the case for me. I remember being in the tent that night. I remember pulling the vodka out of the pillowcase, and I remember asking if anybody wanted any of it. And they didn't. And the reason they gave me for not wanting it is all we had to mix with it was root beer or grape soda. And I said, well, so what? And I took off the top, and I drank half the bottle, and I looked around the tent. Nothing had gotten different. Nothing had changed. So I drank the second half of the bottle. And that was to be the end of my social drinking. Never again after that day did I ever offer anybody a drink out of my bottle. And the only thing that happened to me was after about 15 minutes, I had to go to the bathroom. And it's my belief tonight that after about 15 minutes, if you were to drink a quart of anything, you would have to go to the bathroom. And I remember getting out of the tent, and I shuffled down to the outhouse, and I went in and went to the bathroom. And when I got done, I went to get up. I realized I was absolutely, totally, 100% paralyzed to the toilet seat. I couldn't blink. I didn't feel my heart beating. I couldn't move. And I was overcome with a sense of fear. And, of course, the fear was that somebody else was going to have to come use that outhouse, and there I was, paralyzed to the toilet seat. And I don't know how we intuitively know things. And I intuitively sort of knew that the body was made up of energy, and I somehow figured that if I could gather my energy, I would be all right. So I've often said it was my first formal meditation, because I sat and I gathered my energy. And when it seemed to be all centrally located, when it seemed to be all in one place, I just sort of fell off the toilet, out the door, into the sand, and started crawling back to the tent. Now, of course, since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I've discovered that my entire problem that night was my attitude. If my attitude would have been right, I could have had a fantasy. I was in the Marines. I was being dive-bombed as I was trying to get back to safety. And if my attitude would have been right, it could have been a wonderful experience. Now, in my own defense, I have to say that my pants were still down at my ankles. I had started to get sick. I couldn't quite get through it. I couldn't get around it. And I think under those circumstances, it's a little difficult to have a good attitude. I did somehow manage to get back to the tent. I fell in and I passed out. And when I came to in the morning, I realized nobody was in the tent with me, and I couldn't figure out where they went. So I looked around and I noticed I'd been sick all night long. I'd hit the top of the tent, the side of the tent. You know, like, right, you've never been sick. The floor, I hadn't missed a square inch, and quite frankly, I don't want to be in the tent either, so I got out of there. And that was my first drink of alcohol. And it was the most wonderful, amazing, incredible, fabulous, magnificent spiritual experience I'd ever had. And it must have been because I put some amount of alcohol into my body from that day until the day I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't always drink the kinds of things that you would classify as a beverage. I drank a lot of vanilla extract. I can remember, I used to buy it by the six-pack, and I remember the day the guy at the market called me over, and he said, Patty, I can't let you buy vanilla extract anymore. He said, I can't believe anybody bakes as much as you do, and I got cut off from that supply. I drank a lot of mouthwash. I drank a lot of perfume. Taboo used to be my after-dinner drink of choice. I still have a weakness. If you're wearing it, I may follow you too closely. And if I start lapping at your neck, just brush me aside. I'll be all right. But I'm often tempted when I share, I'm often tempted to introduce myself and say, I'm Patty and I'm a pig. Because I drank, shot, snorted, shoved, crammed, rammed anything into me that made me feel different than how I felt. But alcohol is my drug of choice. I love alcohol. I love everything about it, how it looks, how it sounds, how it sweats, how it tastes. I love everything about alcohol. And what drug of choice means for me is if there's some Jack Daniels here, some Valium, some cocaine, some marijuana, some stuff, drug of choice means I drink the Jack Daniels first, and then I do everything else. And when I was, I told that story a couple of times. My home group is the Thursday woman's meeting at the Canyon Club. I go there. It's a very sick meeting. I go there because I look healthy. And I'd shared that story a couple times. So on my 12th birthday in Alcoholics Anonymous, the women in that group, and we don't usually give gifts, but the women in that group brought me a pig as a birthday present. And boy, it was a Thursday. Unfortunately, I was going out of town for the weekend. I said, geez, I don't know what to do with my pig for the weekend. And so the secretary of the meeting took it home with her for the weekend, and then it got arrested on the beach Sunday. She took it down to the beach, and it got arrested. And I came back to town, and nobody would talk to me about the pig. And then Thursday at the women's meeting, there was a copy of the Laguna Beach paper, and there was a little picture of my pig, and it said, Patty the pig goes to jail. I thought, well, of course. Like mother, like daughter. So since I talked about introducing myself as I'm Patty and I'm a pig, and they gave me a pig, now on Thursdays at that meeting, I say I'm Patty and I drank like a Mercedes-Benz. Hasn't worked as well yet, but I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous. You've all seen the jacket, thank you. No alcohol is one thing, no alcohol and no estrogen is quite another. I may take more off as I go along, just some old ideas die hard. I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous as a result of my 12th drunk driving assault charge. I don't think I have an alcohol problem, I think I have a driving problem. I've always had a driving problem. I told you I know what to do when the light comes on behind me. And when I drank, I knew what to do. There are people in AA who think when that light comes on, it means put the pedal to the metal and go like a bat out of hell. But I have always known it means pull over. And I'm driving, and I pull over, and the officer comes up to the window. And the first thing I do when the officer walks up is I slam my car door open. Now, my intent is to knock him in the private parts. That's what I'm going for. But men are really kind of fussy about their private parts. So as the door's flying open, he jumps back to get out of the way. And when he jumps back to get out of the way, it's really a good thing for me because he backs up enough that I can get him in focus. And I'm thinking, one of him, one of me. One of him, one of me, I think I can take him. One of him, one of me, I think I'll try and I would go for him. Now, it'd be a really good fight for a couple of minutes, but I would never think about the fact that he had a friend back at the car. And the friend had a radio, and the friend would call some more friends, and pretty soon, before five of them, one of me, well, even I know that's not fair, and I say, Uncle. And they cuff me, and they take me away. And but the next time the light comes on and behind me, I know, I pull over. The officer walks up, I slam the door open, try and knock him in his private parts. He jumps back so I can get him in focus, and I'm thinking, one of him, one of me. One of him, one of me, I think I can take him. One of him, one of me, I think I'll try, and I would go for him. Wouldn't remember the friend, the radio, and the friend's friends. Pretty soon, be five or six of them. One of me, it's not a fair fight anymore. I say, Uncle. And I don't do that once or twice. I do that 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 times. Never remember the friend, the radio, and the friend's friends. And that's the insanity of my disease. The insanity of my disease is I do the same thing over and over and over, and I think the results are going to be different. This time, I'm going to take him. This time, it's a fair fight. Never remember the friend in the radio. Now, when you get out of the car like that, they charge you with drunk driving assault. Another resentment I got in Alcoholics Anonymous, I find out here you can get arrested for a single charge of drunk driving. I always got arrested for drunk driving assault. They don't even care that they won the fight. Drunk driving assault. Drunk driving assault. And after a few times, you get a reputation as a violent drunk. They don't care that they won. Violent drunk. I had an opportunity to go to college. I graduated from college with a 3.8 grade point average. I stayed Went to San Diego State. I stayed and took classes for a master's degree. I'm the kind of person, if I'm doing something well, I want to keep doing it. I seem to do college well. Chronic, hopeless, helpless alcoholic, only I don't know it. I'm drinking on a daily basis, and I'm a blackout drinker. I love blackouts. I don't understand people who get nervous by blackouts. Have you ever had anybody come to your meeting and they're like in a panic and they're sweating and they're shaking, and they're just like terrified and they share about, you know, last night I was at this bar and I was drinking and it was 9:20 at night and next thing I knew it was 9:27. I don't know where that 7 minutes went. And oh my God, I knew I had to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I love blackouts. I don't understand that. I love blackouts. I have a degree in journalism. I went into the profession my choice, and as a newspaper person, I know today it was because God gave me a gift, but I often won awards, and because I was in the business, we often gave awards, and it was not unusual for me to be behind a blackout, behind a podium like this in a room full of people, come out of a blackout holding an award, not knowing if I was giving it or receiving it. And so I would say thank you, and I would go sit down, and then somebody would elbow me and tell me I was presenting it to the Kiwanis Club, and I'd have to, you know, hop up and start over again. And that didn't faze me. I love blackouts. There was something to me more, nothing more exciting than leaving work on September 12th, going back to work on September 20th, and discovering you'd been there the entire time in between. I wish I could have a blackout sober. It makes time between paychecks go so much quicker, but... But the other thing about my profession, you see, if you're a journalist, you need to drink. Because you have to be a bar drinker if you're a journalist. Because leads, you get your leads in a bar. Big stories break in the bars. I mean, so whether you want to or not, if you're in that profession, you need to go to the bar after work. I mean, you could work 8, 12, 14 hours, really work hard. You still had to go to the bar after work because that's where the leads were. That's where the news happened. And you know, in all sincerity, I need to tell you that I often did get some great leads in bars. Now, the problem was I would write the notes on those stupid little napkins, and then the glass would sweat and the ink would run all over, and I'd look at it the next day, and I'd think, God, what does this say? Oh, my God, I'm going to have to go back there again tonight. You know, I hope that guy's there again tonight. And I did break a really, really big story one time. One of the members of a local school board married a number of children, was having an affair, and I broke the story about his affair. Now, never once during that time did it ever occur to me I was the woman he was having the affair with. That didn't register, but it's a problem with alcoholism. Some things just sort of miss a cell somewhere along the line. One night I had been working hard. I'd been really working hard, and I'd been to the bar, and it had been a bad night at the bar. I hadn't gotten any leads or anything, I guess. And I left the bar, and I was headed home, and I was thinking. Now, I think all the time. I thought as much drunk as I do sober. I think all the time. I mean, I'm talking to you. I'm thinking about something else. Then I start thinking about the fact that I'm thinking. Then I start thinking I shouldn't be thinking what I'm thinking while I'm thinking what I'm thinking that I shouldn't be thinking. Then I try not to think about what I'm thinking while I'm thinking. And I'll tell you what, I'm grateful. I'm grateful I have a loudspeaker on my head. So everything I thought came barreling out. I mean, that would be truly humiliating. But I think all the time, and I thought a lot as a drinker. And I'm driving home this one night thinking. And as I'm driving home, I turn left onto my street. Well, just as I turned left onto my street, my power steering went out. Slammed into a car on the left-hand side of the street. Of course, I panicked, turned the wheel just a little to get in the middle, and I slammed into a car on the right. Then I slammed into one on the left. Then I slammed into one on the right. Finally pulled into my driveway. I was so relieved that I had gotten home safely. I just sat there in a moment of gratitude. And after a couple minutes, I got out of the car finally, and I went into the house. I was in the house just a couple minutes, not long at all, and the doorbell rang. It's 20 after 2 in the morning. Who is visiting me now? I don't know if you had that problem, but they were always bothering me. If they would have just left me alone, I'd have been okay. It's you and they and them. It's circumstances and conditions. I don't know. It's alcoholism. And I open the door, and it's the Orange County Sheriff. I try and tell him about my car. He wants me to come out on the street. Apparently, he's not mechanical. He doesn't care about my car. He's pointing down the street at all these cars that I have demolished on my way home. And he opens up the back door of his car. Now, I'm in the business. I've been on the ride-along. I don't have time for the ride-along tonight, officer. I've got to be at work early, and I'm explaining to him, and he kind of shoves me into his car. He doesn't care that I've already been on the ride-along. Apparently, he wants me to see it again. Puts me in the back seat of his car. Now, I have a reputation as a violent drunk, only I don't know it. I'm in the back of his car. He shackles my ankles. He cuffs my hands behind my back, because apparently that's what they do if you're a violent drunk. And in Orange County, our sheriffs have a screen between the front seat and the back seat. I've never understood what that's for, but they have like this metal screen there, and he starts me on the ride along. I don't have time. I'm in the back seat. I'm telling him, I don't have time. You need to take me home. I got to be at work early. And he's ignoring me. Next thing I know, he's on the freeway. He's headed north. And I'm still talking, and I guess I'm irritating him because he's not responding to me. And I don't know how you are when people don't respond to you, but I'm in the back seat. The devil flew in me. I honked up a big one, and I just spit right on the back of his head. I can tell you, he was not amused. He started going really fast. Wherever he is taking me to, now he's in a hurry. And he's going really fast. When his speedometer hit 100 miles an hour, he slammed on the brakes. Now I'm shackled and I'm cuffed, and I can't break the fall, and I went face forward into that metal grate. My glasses broke. I had blood everywhere, but I'll never forget that night when they were taking my mugshot. They kept referring to me as Waffle Face because I had the... And I don't know, it's alcoholism. I think it's the cops. I think it's you and they and them. I think it's circumstances and conditions. I think it's my boss. I think it's a lot of stuff. It never occurs to me anything to do with alcohol. I think I drink because I want to drink. I don't know that I don't have a choice. I don't know that at 13 years old, I put alcohol into an alcoholic body, and from that day on, I had no choice. I think I drink because I want to drink. I went to court, and I drank it during the time in Southern California where they didn't get their underwear in such a knot about drunk driving. I drank during the time, good thing or bad thing. I'd call my attorney. I'd pay him $1,000, which was an awful lot of money. He'd write a letter. He'd make a phone call. He'd do whatever, and that would be the end of it. But at the end of what I pray God is my last drunk driving, the days of the attorney were gone. Southern California was getting really irritable about speeding a 2-ton piece of metal down the freeway at 80 miles an hour, blowing a 3.8 on the alcohol, or 0.38 on the alcohol thing. They were getting really a little perturbed by it all, and I got pulled over one more time. I fought with the cop one more time. I stood up, and he was giving me the field sobriety test, and I was doing really, really well. But I'm the kind of person, I'm very anal, and I'm very proud of it. I get released from jail, I always get the arrest report. If anybody here is in their last 30 days, you might want to try this. Always get the arrest report and read it. Because they'd write right in there where you made your mistake. So that you can practice that part, so that next time you'll get that part right. And you see, I always knew there'd be a next time. I always knew there'd be a next time. So I had practiced field sobriety tests a lot. I am really, really good at field sobriety tests. And on what I pray God was the last one, by that time I knew touch your finger to your nose meant this, it doesn't mean that. I knew how to walk, I knew the whole deal. I had given myself an A+, I was doing a fine job. But at the end of it, the officer asked me to say the ABCs backwards. Well, the time before I had responded with, well, I can't even do that sober. Well, then I had just confessed. So this time when he asked me to say the ABCs backwards, I said, okay, and I turned around. And I said, ABCs. See, you think it's funny. He wasn't even a little amused. I was turned around, he cuffed me, and he took me to Orange County Jail, and he put me in a cell with criminals, and I knew I didn't belong there. I mean, there were prostitutes in there, there were burglars, there were women who'd been arrested for beating their husbands, which I have never thought should be a crime, but in Southern California, they lock you up for it. And I knew I didn't belong there, so I tried to organize a prison break. I explained the plan very carefully to the prisoners. We're going to get our coffee cups, we're going to beat them on the bars, and the marshal comes to see what's going on. I'm going to throw my arm around the bars, get her around the neck, get her keys, and we're getting out of here. And I heard something I was to hear in Alcoholics Anonymous. One of those prisoners looked at me and she said, why don't you sit down and shut up? And I said, fine, then y'all stay, but I'm getting out. Now, I was going like a madwoman on those bars. Now, there's a couple things I didn't realize with styrofoam cups. The first one is they don't make a lot of noise. The second one is the bars have a tendency to eat them up. And when the bars ate it up and it got to my knuckles and it got painful, I sat down and I shut up. They released me on an OR. I hadn't been released on an OR in a long time. I knew they were making a mistake, but you really shouldn't be the one telling them about it. I went to court on that charge. I was 26 years old. I was drunk that morning. It's the only way I went to court, the laundromat, the grocery store, to work. It's the only way I did anything. I stood there 26 years old, drunk, and because of my past record, I was being sentenced to 10 years in prison. And in the middle of sentencing me, the expression on the judge's face changed. The tone of his voice got different. And I know he was as surprised at what he was saying as I was at what I was hearing. Because he looked at me and he said, I know this won't work for you, but I'm going to offer you one more chance. And he offered me an alternative. And part of that alternative was meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I wish I could tell you I left the courtroom. I came here. I looked at the 12 steps. I worked them all in the first week and skyrocketed to recovery. And if Joanne and Chuck weren't here, I probably would tell you that. But but that's not my story. I stood in court that morning trying to make a decision. Jail or the alternative? Jail or the alternative? The attorney was gone. I have the public defender standing next to me. He's putting his elbow on my ribs trying to get me to make a decision. Jail or the alternative? I've been to jail. I know how to do jail. There's more alcohol and other drugs inside the institution than there are some days on the street. If you know what to do, who to do it to, and you're willing to go to any lengths, and I always was. But standing there that morning, I had what I know tonight is a moment of clarity, because as drunk as I was, I knew as clearly as I have ever known anything that if I went to jail one more time, I would either be institutionalized or I would become institutionalized for life. And so I took the alternative, and I drank for 3 more months. In retrospect, I can tell you that I drank with a sense of urgency and a desperation that I had never known. I didn't drink a greater quantity. Physically, it would have been impossible to drink a greater quantity of alcohol. But I drank with a sense of urgency and a desperation that I had never known. And on October 4th, 1975, the day before I was to go back to court to tell the judge what it was I was doing with the alternative he gave me, on that day I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was a Sunday night. It was a speaker meeting. As far as I know, I had never heard the words Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know what you people were going to do to me or for me. I thought it was something like the PTA or Parents Without Partners, and, well, a lot of days it is, but I had no idea. I went to that first meeting. I can't tell you who spoke that night, but I heard two things in that meeting. I heard, we don't drink between meetings. I quickly looked around, and I didn't see any of you drinking in the meeting. And I thought, if you're not drinking in the meeting and you don't drink between the meetings, when do you drink? And I don't know how that affects other newcomers, but it made me really nervous. I could not figure out why the judge sent me to a place where people didn't drink. I would have understood if he sent me to the Sears School of Safe Driving. I didn't understand why he sent me to a place where people didn't drink. And the other thing I heard in that meeting that night was that the answers were in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So after the meeting, I stole the book. I mean, God knows I need to have the answers. I can't tell you how irritated I was when I got home. I read the book when I got home. I was so irritated, not only could I not find the answers in that book, I couldn't even find the questions. And I thought, oh, dear God, I've stolen the wrong book, and I'm going to have to go back and get the right one. And I'm a thief. It's humiliating for a thief to have stolen the wrong book. Of course, I don't know I'm a thief. I have a disease that manifests itself in justification, rationalization. I don't have a clue. No matter what it is I do, I explain it to you why it had to be that way. And as I'm explaining it to you, I'm hearing it. And as I'm hearing it, I'm believing it. And I don't know I'm a thief. I had to stay sober a while and have my sponsor tell me I'm a thief. You know, it's really critical you have a sponsor. I think it's really important you don't have a sponsor who's as emotionally involved in your life as you are. It'll irritate you sometimes, but they have a whole different perspective of your life. And my sponsor, you tell me what you think. I'm in a bar drinking. The bar closes. I find some keys. I pick them up. I go to the parking lot, and I find the car that they fit. And I'm driving home. My sponsor and the San Diego police think this is Grand Theft Auto. I think it's alternative transportation. I just need to get home. I just need to get home. But I'm a thief, and it's humiliating for a thief to have stolen the wrong book. So Wednesday, with 4 days of sobriety, I went to my second meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to my second meeting to get the answer book. That's the only reason I came back here. I don't think it matters why you come back. I think what's important is that you come back. I came back to get the answer book. The second meeting I went to, and Chuck and Joanne were there, it was a small discussion meeting. And in that meeting, I heard, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. And I looked around the room, and I looked around the room, and I looked around the room, and I could not figure out what it was you had that was so hot that I should be willing to go to any length to get it. I mean, think of it. Look at the person next to you. Unless you're sleeping with them, what is it? I mean, I... Some of you had nice jewelry. If your rings were loose during the Lord's Prayer, they were mine. Some of you have nice cars. I'm a car thief. I know how to get those. Some of you have nice spouses. We all know how to get those. We don't keep them well, but we know how to get them. And then I saw him. And I truly believe there's a him for each of us. This guy was a skinny little fellow. He was bald-headed. He wore baggy pants, not like the kids do today. I don't know about in Las Vegas, but in Southern California, I work with teenagers. I think it's my penance. Oops, if any of you darlings ever hear this, I love you, I love you, I love you. I work with kids who wear pants so bad. I mean, their pants have no relationship to their body size. And honest to God, they could put a homeless family in there with them. I mean, Dick's pants weren't that big, but they were baggy. And he had tennis shoes on with no shoelaces, but the holes were there where they should have been, and he nodded out during the meeting. And I quickly assessed the situation. I figured he was shooting heroin. Because folks who shoot heroin nod out. And I can probably do this thing and not drink if I can shoot a little heroin. So I found out where he worked, and the next day I snuck down to his office. And I said, Dick, I have to do this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous to stay out of jail, and I don't know how to do it. And he told me if I would go to meetings and read the book and talk to other alcoholics and not drink, so I'll guarantee you, you won't get drunk. And if you don't get drunk, your life will get different. And I'm grateful he told it to me that way. He didn't tell me my life would get better. He didn't tell me my relationships would get better, my family life would get better, my finances would get better, my employment situation would get better, my sex life would get better. He didn't tell me any of it would get better. And I'm grateful, because none of it has. So, a little hope for the newcomer. But it's all gotten different. And as I stand here tonight, I can tell you from the top of my head to the tip of my toes, I have never had it so good. You see, I don't know good from bad for me. I'm going through something I think is good for me, it generally turns out to be bad for me. And I'm going through something I think is bad for me, and it generally turns out to be good for me. I don't know good from bad for me. I've gone through times in my sobriety where my entire life has fallen apart. I've gone through times sober where it had seemed to me that God brought me this far and then took off to tend to one of you. And mine was all falling to pieces. And because I'm so dramatic, I like to refer to it as the dark night of the soul. When I'm in it, when you're in it, it'll pass. But when I'm in it... And it seems to me, but what my experience is when I'm in that place where it's all falling apart, I don't drink and I don't die. And I don't drink, and I don't die, and I don't drink, and I don't die. And I get far enough beyond it to every time be able to look back and in retrospect see that every time I have thought my life was falling apart, what was really happening is it was falling together. And it had to be exactly that way for God to move me to where he had me be. I don't let go of stuff easy. I don't surrender easily. Everything that has been removed from me has claw marks on it. I just don't let it go very easily. And it has to always be that way for God to move me to where he'd have me be. And so I don't know good from bad for me, but I know different. And every area of my life is different than it was the day I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have never had it so good. Left to my own devices, I had to shortchange myself. The only thing I came here for was to stay out of jail. That's all I wanted out of this deal. And if I'd have had it my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. If a single day in the last 24 years I'd have had it my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. There is a God that has a plan for me beyond my wildest imagination. I have a really wild imagination. Beyond my wildest imagination, there's a plan for me. I believe that, oh man, you know what? I hadn't believed another human being in a long time. And this is just my perspective, and it may or may not be true, but it's my perspective. My perspective of growing up is that people hurt me all the time. My perspective of being a child is that people disappointed me and they let me down and they hurt me. And as a small child, I'd made a decision that I didn't want to be hurt anymore. And as a small child, I began to build a brick wall to keep you out. And that brick wall kept you out. What I never knew about that wall is it made me a prisoner inside. I lived behind that wall in isolation and loneliness. And alcohol didn't allow me to come out and play. What alcohol did was it made it okay for me to be back there. And because of that wall, I hadn't trusted anybody in a long time. But by the grace of God, I trusted that old man that night. I was later to find out that he'd been sober longer than I'd been alive. And the reason that he nodded out in meetings is he had something inside that I didn't have a clue as to what it was. He had a serenity and a peace inside. He was right with us, he was right with himself, and he was right with God, and I didn't have a clue as to what that was about. But I believed him, and I had the book, so every night I'd open it to chapter 3, and I'd read the line that says, "Most of us are unwilling to admit we're real alcoholics." I'd say amen and close the book, and that was reading the book. My court program said I had to go to 2 meetings a week. I was willing to go to any lengths to stay out of jail, even though I thought it was really, really obsessive. I mean, they already told me I don't drink between meetings, and the answers were in the book. I couldn't figure out what there was left for you to tell me. But I was willing to go to any lengths to stay out of jail, so I went to the 2 meetings a week my court program said I had to go to. And I'd go down to Laguna Beach to the Canyon Club where they have AA meetings, not for a meeting, but I'd go have a cup of coffee. On the way out, I'd say hi, Jim, to the manager. He'd say hi, Patty, and that was talking to another alcoholic. And the only thing I did right is I didn't drink. And I didn't drink, and I didn't drink, and I didn't drink. And I was not a kind, loving newcomer. I was trying my hardest to get thrown out of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, it never occurred to me you could just leave. I thought you had to get thrown out. And I was trying to get thrown out of Alcoholics Anonymous, but you wouldn't throw me out, no matter what I did. You would just smile, and usually some little blue-haired lady, smile and say, "Keep coming back." And I'd flip her off and wave my court card in her face and tell her I didn't have a choice, and then I'd do something else, and you'd tell me to come back, and you told me to come back, and you told me to come back. One night I heard the traditions read. Now, I know tonight they read them at every meeting. I never heard them. I think that's when we chat with our neighbor or something. I never heard them read, but this one night I heard them. The third tradition, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. I leapt out of my chair. I was so excited. I said, that's it. I don't have a desire to stop drinking. I want to drink more than I want to breathe. I can't stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was on my way out the door. And an old-timer grabbed me, and thank God for the old-timers. The guy grabbed a hold of me, and he said, "Patty," he said, "there's a judge in South Orange County Court. He has a desire for you to stop drinking. And in your case, we're going to let that be enough." And I stayed on somebody else's desire. I don't think it matters whose desire you're here on. I don't think it matters what your motive is or what your intention is. I think what's important is that you're here. And thank God those old timers understood. And I have to tell you, that man that saved my life that night died a couple weeks ago, and we had a memorial for him on Sunday. And if it hadn't been for him, I would have left Alcoholics Anonymous. Not knew what happened to me. 8.5 months of not drinking. You know, I've been in a lot of pain in sobriety. I don't know, I think Bob's got like this Pollyanna recovery. He never has a bad moment. And the other thing I want to know, has anybody ever seen Bob without those boots on? I asked his wife earlier. She said no. I've had some... Life is sometimes painful. Things happen in life. What I'm grateful for when I'm having a good day, what I'm grateful for is that as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I get to participate. I get to show up for it all, good days and not so good days, joyous days and painful days, wonderful moments and sad moments. I get to show up for it all. And sometimes life is just painful. Sometimes it's hard, sometimes it hurts. But I get to show up for it all. And I've been in pain in the last 24 years, but I need to tell you, I have never been in the kind of pain that I was in at 8.5 months sober. The pain of not drinking and not recovering is the greatest pain I have ever been in. And 8.5 months away from my last drink, that pain drove me to my knees. And on my knees, I took the first step of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. I admitted I was powerless over alcohol. Whenever I drink alcohol, I'm damned to continue to drink. Whenever I drink alcohol, I have no choices in my life. Whenever I get into the ring with alcohol, I lose. Whether I'm fighting it because I'm drinking it, or I'm fighting it because you're drinking it. Whenever I get into the ring with alcohol, I lose, and my life had become unmanageable. Alcohol had become my mother, my father, my God, my friend, my lover, my companion, my support. And at some point it had turned. I believe tonight it was in the middle of my first drink, but at some point it had turned. It began to strip me of self-esteem, self-worth, dignity, decency, honesty, integrity, pride, all the things we have going for us as human beings. By the time I got here, it had taken it all. And alcohol controlled every area of my life. My life had become unmanageable because I had no choices. When I drink alcohol, I'm damned to live the same way over and over and over.
and my life had become unmanageable, and I was powerless over alcohol. And for me, it took 8.5 months of not drinking to get far enough away from my last drink to see the evidence of my alcoholism. You all saw it when I came in. But you gave me the dignity to do what I had to do for as long as I had to do it, until I got far enough away from my last drink to see the evidence. And I'm grateful for that. The steps for me are there is no way to get from where I was on October 4th, 1975, to where I am tonight, except for the power and the magic of the 12 steps of recovery. And this is just my experience with the steps. So if you have a different experience, talk to your sponsor after the meeting. Don't argue with me. I had somebody one night tell me I did not have my experience. It threw me into a tailspin for about a week. But I'm a loner by nature. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't change your nature. What Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me is it gives me the courage and strength to do the things I need to do in spite of my nature. But I'm a loner by nature. I love to be by myself. My favorite place to be is on my couch alone. Every once in a while I hear us say, you know, if an alcoholic alone is in bad company, I entertain myself beyond. I have no social skills. Well, I do. I have one, but I used it at about 4 this afternoon, so I'm fresh out for the day. The most difficult thing for me to do is to be here with you. It's just very hard for me. But you give me the courage and strength that I need in order to do the things I need to do in spite of my nature. You know you're a loner if you don't like AA potlucks. That's generally the indicator. And I don't have a problem with God. I really don't have a problem. I have one problem with God. My only problem with God is I believe we are all God's children, and I have always wanted to be an only child. That's my only problem with God. But for me, the power greater than myself in step two, for me, was not God. Because, you see, as a loner, if I had come to believe that God was going to restore me to sanity, I'd have sat on my couch. God would have flown in, sprinkled me with sanity, taken off to wherever it is God hangs out. And that would have been the end of it. I would have never had to do another thing. I would be sitting on my couch tonight watching ER reruns. And somebody else would be here. So for me, the power greater than myself was the action, the steps 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I came to believe that through taking the action, the steps, I would be restored to sanity. And for me, sanity is how I think. You see, I've always tried to think my way into right living. That never worked for me. As a result of the steps, I've been able to act my way into right thinking. And the book says it'll happen. In the discussion of step 10, it says, for by this time, sanity will have been restored. Through taking the action, the steps, I have been able to act my way into right thinking. I have never been able to think my way into right living. Sometimes my solution, I think of solutions to problems all the time. Sometimes the solutions are worse than the problem. What I know today is to run it by you. What I know today is to call my sponsor. I've worked in the same field for 19 years, and I'm really, really good at what I do for a living. And I can share that with you because I know I don't do it. I show up and God works through me. I get the paycheck, and I'm grateful for that, but God does the work. I just show up. And I'm really, really good at what I do. But, you know, sometimes I'm driving to work and I have this thought. Oh, my God, today's the day they're going to fire you. Today's the day they're going to find out you can't do this job. Today's the day they're going to call you in and say, you know what, we didn't mean to hire you. We meant to hire that other patio. Today's the day. And I used to have that thought when I was drinking. Now, when I was drinking, I would have that thought. And I would curse them off and flip them off. And I'd start bad-mouthing them. And I'd pull into a bar and I'd order a drink. And I'd tell the bartender about those lousy SOBs I used to work for. And I'd order another drink and tell them how their whole company was going to go down the toilet because I was no longer worked there. And I would order another drink and I would start plotting their revenge. And I would order another drink and I'd have their cars blown up and the building blown up. And I would never even get to work to get fired. Today I have that thought because I'm human. You see, I thought nobody told me this. This is another one of my thoughts. I thought if I worked the steps really, 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 really hard with enough passion and zealousness, I would somehow rise above human. I would somehow float up here and never have a feeling that I judged as negative. And the truth for me in working the steps is I've come into my humanness. And as a human being, I have all the feelings human beings have. Fear, insecurity, doubt. So today when I have that thought, I have you. And I call my sponsor. Now, I don't know why. If it's her problem, it is very, very serious. If it's my problem, she laughs at me. And I call her up and I tell her, today's the day they're going to fire me. And she laughs, and she says, honey, you just go ahead and go to work. After they fire you, call me back. I go to work, and they don't fire me. That's my humanness, and that's the difference between then and now. is that I have you at Coward's Drink and Use. I did that on a daily basis for 13 years. It takes a lot of courage and a lot of strength to continue to choose to recover, and I don't have it. So I come here, and you give me the courage and strength that I need in order to choose to continue to recover. And today I have you, and I never had you before. And if I'd have had it my way, I'd have missed it. You see, I didn't come here for that. I just came here to stay out of jail. And that's all I wanted out of this deal. Steps, I don't have time to talk. I love the steps. I don't have time to talk about them. I have just spent too much time being drunk, which I believe is the story of all our lives. We just spent too much time being drunk. But I want to, step three for me said made a decision. The book says, although our decision was vital, it had very little permanent effect unless immediately followed by action. Make the decision, then take an action, the fourth step. I wrote my inventory. I did my fifth step with someone I didn't plan to do it with, but I think God will put us in front of the person with whom we're to share. And when I shared my story with her, that big brick wall I had built between me and you, that wall didn't fall down. One brick came out of that wall. But every time I've shared with another alcoholic, another brick has come out of that wall. Till tonight, I have no brick wall between me and you. I have a little styrofoam thing I throw up sometimes, because sometimes I get afraid, but I have no brick wall between me and you. I no longer live in isolation and loneliness. Step six and seven for me are the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. We tell new people don't leave before the miracle happens, and then we don't tell them what the miracle is. The miracle for me is step six and seven. I went home from doing my fifth step. I opened the big book by coincidence to the part where it talks about steps six and seven. And I started reading that. When I became aware of what I was reading, I was in the middle of the seventh step prayer. And when I became aware of what I was reading, that prayer took the longest journey ever anything has ever taken for me, the journey from my head to my heart. And when I became aware of what I was reading, I knew that I believed it. And I finished reading the prayer, and the thing that it says in the book happened to me. I walked through the archway to freedom. I walked away from the person I have been all of my life to start to become the person God intended for us to be. The best I've ever described myself when I came here was an animal with latent human tendencies. That's what walked through the door. It's because the steps work and because you've been willing to share with me, I become very kind, very loving, very gentle, very caring, very nurturing. Of course, now they're telling me it's codependency and I have to recover from it. I love the person who I am. I'm tempted to write a book, Women Who Love Themselves Too Much. And I think too many people leave before that happens. Too many people leave before they give themselves that opportunity. If you're new, don't leave until then. Don't leave until you start to become the person God intended for you to be. Steps eight and nine for me are conventional ways of getting rid of conventional guilt. I felt guilty because I was guilty. I did a lot of things to a lot of people for one more drink. I hurt a lot of people for one more drink. The only thing I've ever wanted to do since I was in the fourth grade was be a writer. I had an opportunity to go to college. I went into that profession. I did very well, and I gave it up for one more drink. Whatever it was, if it was it or a drink, I took the drink. You were a drink, I took a drink. The job or a drink, I took a drink. The career or a drink, I took it. Whatever it was, I took the drink. I did a lot of things to a lot of people. I hear people say, you know, when they're making their list, well, I put my name on the top of the list. My alcoholism, if I put my name on the top of the list, I would never get to number two. The amends to you, you belong there, not me. And the amends for me were not about sorry. Sorry, sorry, sorry. I'd said sorry all my life. Every time I got caught, sorry, sorry, sorry. And then I, sorry, 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 and then I would do it again. Then I'd get caught, sorry, 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 and then I'd do it again. Sorry, 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 then I'd do it again. The amends were more than sorry. The amends for me were living my life differently. And I didn't know how to do it. I don't know how to live out there. But you shared with me. You shared with me how to be a mother, how to be a sister, how to be a daughter, how to be a friend. I didn't know how to do it. Did not know how to be a friend. And I started making amends, and I started living differently, except for my father. Hated my father. Grew up in an alcoholic home. My father's the alcoholic. He was abusive. My perspective is I was the target of his abuse. I hated my father. I'm not making amends to him. In fact, I would send him the big book wrapped in brown paper anonymously to his home and to his job and to the bar he drank in. And a friend of my sponsor one night said, Jesus, you're obsessed with him. And I said, well, I want him to get sober, work the steps, and make amends to me. I'm not making amends to him. I hate him. Then something happened to me. I'd stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous long enough that I'd started to know people for, you know, more than 2 days in a row. And I'd start, like, having a friend. And I have a friend for a few days, but then they would annoy the hell out of me. They'd, like, breathe too hard, or You know, they'd ask me some stupid question, like, where were you last night? Well, if I wanted you to know, I'd have told you ahead of time. And you can't be my friend anymore. But then I would find another friend. There's, you know, this is not the bedrock of mental health. You know, I'd find another one, and we'd be friends for a few days, but then that person would annoy me. It's like, you know, do something stupid, like, I don't, stupid. And I'd have to get rid of them, and then I'd have to find another friend. And I said to my sponsors, I don't know why these people annoy me so much. I mean, the rest of you seem to have these friendships. I mean, I don't get it. And she explained it to me. She said, Patty, she said, you hate your father. She said, you cannot hate one person. Hate doesn't know that it stays directed at one person. When you hate, it spreads through every relationship you're trying to have. You're never going to be able to have a relationship until you make amends to your father. So I made amends to my father, not because I want him to be my father, not because I want him to be my friend, and I want him to be my pal. I made amends to my father because I wanted to have relationships with you. It doesn't matter what my motive is. It doesn't matter what I think. There's no chapter in the book into thinking or into right motive. The chapter in the book is into action. It doesn't matter what my motive is. What matters is what my actions are. I made amends to my father, and we're not close. I mean, but I sent him Father's Day cards and Christmas cards and holiday cards, and I would send pictures, and I would be the kind of daughter that you shared with me how to be. And my father got very ill several months ago, and he had cancer, and as a result of the chemotherapy, I'm not a doctor, but somehow it fried his bones, and the tumor grew, and it broke his back. In the last 3 weeks of my father's life, he was in a hospital bed in a convalescent home, and because you taught me how to be a daughter, because you told me how to make amends, and you told me it was about not saying sorry, but living my life differently. I went and saw my father every week that he was in that hospital, and then I was going to go on a Monday, and my brothers and sisters all flew in on Friday, and they said, you know, the nurses say he's not going to live till Monday. And because I was busy in Alcoholics Anonymous, I couldn't go until Monday, and I said, you know, if I'm supposed to see him, he'll be there Monday. And they were there all weekend with him, and he wasn't responding, he wasn't talking, he wasn't nothing, he just laid there for the weekend, and they kept saying he wasn't going to live through the weekend. He wasn't going to live through the weekend. And Monday, when I had said I would go see him, I went. And I walked in, and I talked to him. And he wasn't talking back to me, and I wasn't saying anything really deep. I meant I was talking about Nick at Night, which was on TV. But I was talking to him. And then I asked him if I could have some of his morphine. And he laughed. And he hadn't responded all weekend, but he laughed, and I asked him if I could have some of his morphine. And my father never got it that I was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My father thought it was a phase I was going through. He'd been to AA a few times. One day he was drinking a screwdriver, telling me AA didn't work. I told him it worked best if he didn't drink, but he never got it. But he laughed when I asked him if I could have some of his morphine. And I visited with him for about an hour, and on the way out, I gave him a kiss, and I told him I loved him. And I'd never been able to tell my father that before, but I told him that I loved him. And I said, but Dad, you got to stop. I said, the nurses are complaining that every time they come in here, you're patting them on the butt. I mean, you got to knock it off. And he laughed. And that was my last, the last time I saw my father. He died the next morning. And I don't know if it was as important to me, but I was able to share that with my brothers and sisters who had sat there all weekend with him and he wasn't responding. I was able to share with them that my father laughed twice on my last visit with him. And so they don't have you. They don't have you to take their hand and walk them through their grief. And I was able to share that last day with my father, gave them something to hold on to other than the weekend they had spent with him. And I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous for that. I just came here to stay out of jail. If I'd had it my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. The single day in the last 24 years, I'd have had it my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. Steps 10, 11, and 12 for me are the recovery steps. They're the steps that allow me to continue to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous. 10 says the process is powerful. Keep using it. Keep writing about it, talking about it. Ask God to remove the defect. Make amends when necessary, and then turn your attention to somebody you can help. What is it I can do for you? How can I be of service? I have a disease that manifests itself in selfish and self-centered. I cannot think about myself when I'm being of service to you. What is it I can do for you? How can I be of service? And somehow these big, big problems that I have, these huge problems that I have, when I'm focused on them, nothing happens. When I turn my attention to you, God can scoot in and take care of the problem for me. What is it I can do for you? Step 11, my prayer in the morning is very simply, thy will be done. I'm so naive, I truly believe the rest of the day is God's business. My job is to not drink, show up, and live life to the fullest. My prayer at night is a little scarier. I'm going to offer it to anybody who wants to use it. My prayer at night is, dear God, please have people treat me tomorrow exactly the way I treated people today. And when I know I'm going to say that when I know I'm going to say that prayer tonight, it will hold me in good stead. It keeps me from returning a flip-off to those people on the freeway. It keeps me from counting the number of items in the person with the 10-item or less checkout lane and telling the cashier about it. That prayer will hold me in good stead. Step 12 is the greatest gift you've ever given me. The opportunity to take a little of my past and give it to another alcoholic. To look into the eyes of another alcoholic and say, honey, you don't have to live that way anymore. Take my hand, come with me, sit in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you don't have to live that way a day at a time. I'm going to end with a story before the yellow light goes on. It's a story of the man that goes to see St. Peter, and he asks St. Peter to show him heaven and hell. St. Peter takes him to a room, and it says hell on the door. But when they open the door, it's a banquet inside, tables and tables and tables of food, any kind of food you could ever think of, as much food as you could ever imagine. The people in that room are starving, they're hungry, and they're dying. And the reason they're starving is they have those long wooden spoons tied to their hands, and spoons just a little bit too long, and they can't quite get the food to their mouth. And so they're sitting amongst plenty, and they're starving. And that's how I was before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was out there amongst plenty, and I was starving. Then he took them to a room marked heaven, and inside that room was the same thing. A banquet, tables and tables and tables of food, any kind of food you could ever imagine. And the people in that room had those long wooden spoons tied to their hands, too, and the spoons were just a little bit too long, and they couldn't quite get the food to their mouth. The people in that room were full, and they were happy, and they were content. And the difference was is that one man was taking a spoonful of food, and he was feeding the man next to him. And he was taking a spoonful of food and feeding the person across, and she was feeding somebody else. And that's how Alcoholics Anonymous works for me. I don't have my own answers. I have to come here and let you feed me. And every once in a while, if I'm lucky, I get to give a spoonful of this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous to another alcoholic. And you don't have to have a year, 5 years, or 10 years. If you have one day, you have something to give to the man or woman walking through the door. If you have one day, you have something to give to the person sitting next to you. When we stand up to pray tonight, if you have one day, you have courage to give to the person on your right, and you have strength to give to the person on your left. If you have one day, you have something to feed to the man or woman in Alcoholics Anonymous or coming through the door. When I was 4 days sober, an old man told me if I didn't drink, I wouldn't get drunk. And if I didn't get drunk, my life would get different, and he didn't lie to me. And the other thing I know for sure, and I end with it because it's been my experience, and I pray, God, it's your experience. We already heard tonight when Chapter 5 was read, it's a line in Chapter 5 that says, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Thank you.